Tony Deanda. Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Mike Lynch. Ron Martin.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Don O'Reilly.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, we have two announcements.
Yes, just to bring to the board's attention that we have Rick Santos today here at the board meeting. He has started his training to become the new retirement administrator in November. Rick's on board, and he will be a great asset to us. I believe that he's going to bring the board to and the whole organization to the next level. Very, very good asset for the board to have on board.
We're going to have a profit every month.
Can't predict what the markets will be. Just operationally. And the other thing is, we have somebody coming on board. We also have somebody leaving us. Hank Scow will be retiring next month. And we wanted to remind the board members that when our accountant left at the end of the fiscal year, he was the one doing all the accounting last year. And so we want to provide a presentation of the GFOA Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting, and which will stay with the board, of course. And the popular annual financial reporting award also. And this is something that you can keep. This is the Award of Financial Reporting Achievement to Hank Scow, Operations Manager, Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association, California, from the GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association of the United States and Canada. And I have to say that you've always been a diligent employee. We could actually set our clocks by you coming and going. And everything that you've done has been excellent. 4:26 every day. Everything you've done has been great, and you've always pitched in, as we did last year with the accountant being gone. You pitched right in, got it done, got an excellent award and so on from our accounting statements. We really appreciate having you and wish you the best in your retirement, Hank. Thank you very much.
And I just want to say, you probably know this, but I know this really well, is that there's a fantastic staff here, and they do a great job. It made my life so much easier. This has been a fun place to work for the last 7 years or so. And I really have enjoyed my time here. I'm going to miss it, but everybody retires. At least I think they do. So anyway, I've had a great time here, and I've enjoyed it. I've also enjoyed actually attending the board meetings and watching kind of discourse between the different members. It's been very entertaining and educational. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's
anything
it.
Else?
Sure. That's it.
Okay, we'll move on to public comment. If anybody would like to make a comment on anything that is not on the agenda. Seeing none, we'll move on to consent agenda items. Does any member of the board wish to pull any item from the consent calendar? Seeing none, then I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second. Motion's been made and seconded. We accept the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you. Motion carries. Takes us to item six, semi-annual reports from Dodge and Cox.
And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Wendell Burkhofer. I'm the equity portfolio manager that works on Spencer's account, and I've been at Dodge & Cox for 24 years. It's been a pleasure to work with Tom and Hank in the time that I've been your primary manager, and wish you the best, Hank. And I don't know if we're going to see you again, Tom. Maybe.
Oh yeah, a couple.
It's been a pleasure working with both of you. I'm going to start things off, but I'll let my colleague introduce himself.
Bob Thompson. I'm in the fixed income portfolio industry. I'm with Dodge & Cox for 19 years, and used to come to report to the bureau to look at the fixed income portfolio. And as the Wendell kind of time, and what happened to you?
So we want to be respectful of your time, so I think we'll move quickly. But how much time have you allocated for us, just so we're aware?
About 30 minutes or so.
Okay, we will have to move very quickly. I'm just going to make a couple quick introductory comments and give you an update on the firm, and Bob's going to be fixed in from first, and then I'll be happy to go after that. Obviously, this has been a period of what I would call really significant volatility in the capital markets. I mean, I'm not sure in my career I've seen anything quite like what we've seen in the last few weeks. I mean, the crisis a few years ago was volatile, and this is almost schizophrenic. I mean, it's up, down, day by day. So we'll talk a little bit about that after we kind of quickly get you through the mid-year report. Because so much has changed, and I checked in with Paul ahead of time on this, so much has changed since June 30th that I think we would be remiss not to comment a little bit more on that as we go through the presentation. Just very quickly on the firm, Dodd & Cox continues to be quite stable in terms of our investment team. You see on slide one our equity and fixed income key professionals. We did have one equity analyst resign last month, Yasha Goffman, who had been with us for 16 years. He decided he wanted to relocate his family to Southern California. We tried to think about how that might work. And because it's so important that our team all be in one place and the communication that we have every day in the halls and as we meet, we just could not make that work for us. So he has left. We've reassigned his energy industry responsibilities to someone else. He is not on the policy committee that oversees your equity portfolio, so no change there. However, on the fixed income side, one of our professionals, Peter Lambert, who's been with the firm for 20 plus years, is going to be retiring at the end of the year. And so just a few months ago, in the first quarter, he dropped off of our fixed income policy committee in preparation for his retirement. So that's one other change. Slide two shows you people we've hired and who have left over the last few years. Not much to really go over there, except that, once again, we continue to be quite stable. And then on page three, you see our total assets under management as of June 30th. And obviously, that's changed a lot in the last couple months. But just under $200 billion as of June 30th, with about 60% plus or minus in equities, and then the other just under 40% in fixed income. So that's just a quick update on the firm. Unless there are questions, I'm going to turn it over to Bob to start with fixed income.
Wendell and I were talking on the way out here, and we thought the last 2 months, as you mentioned, was kind of schizophrenic almost because of the way the market was reacting. But there does seem to be two overarching themes. One is what's going on in Europe, and how are they going to take care of the pigs and all that stuff. But it really kind of comes down to what's going on in the banks in Europe. And they can't see. I think the great fear is you can't see into them. There's one thing that we did do since 2007 is there has been a remarkable opening of the transparency of our current banking system. And I think our banking system has had a remarkable recovery, not so much in Europe. And that's one of the big concerns. And it's still evolving. Nobody can predict what's going on. And I think the longer it goes on, you see more and more people saying, okay, well, what am I safe in? I just want to, and I'll talk about this in a couple minutes. Just give me treasuries. So you see a lot of that going on. So that's one thing. The other thing is talking about treasuries and this concern about the sentiment over the last 2 months of going from, you know, kind of, we're going along with a grand reasonable economy. It looks like we'll grow out of it eventually. So all of a sudden, it's almost depressing for behavior in the last 2 months. And it's not helped by the decision-making process in Washington, D.C., nor the decision-making that's going on in Europe. It has really changed almost the outlook of everybody. People now start talking about a double-digit recession. Not necessarily it's going to happen, but that seems to be the fear that's going on. So that's kind of the big picture.
And anything else you mentioned that kind of...
And I'll just add one thing to that, is that it's interesting, we were talking about this as we were walking back from lunch on the way over here, it is interesting to think a year ago when we were sitting here, we were talking about some of the exact same issues. The Eurozone crisis was beginning to be taken pretty seriously with Greece, the next one of the pigs that was under stress. There were worries about a double-dip recession in the U.S. The equity market had a pretty significant correction in the second quarter last year. It started in spring and went into the summer. And then the Fed announced what was called QE2, and it was sort of off to the races again. The equity market had a huge rally towards the end of the year. The bond market recovered nicely as well, and corporate spreads narrowed. So I'm not saying it's exactly the same this year, because I think the European sovereign credit problem is worse. And there has been more concern, I think, about our leadership in Washington this year in terms of the process that we went through on the debt ceiling. And the mood seems quite different. But I do bring that up as an example, because last year we didn't get a double dip. This year people think maybe, again, we're at risk for that, and only time will tell. So, but that will kind of go through the fixed income.
Okay, on page 5 is just the assets under management. This is as of the end of June, and you can see it's about $436 million, and that is after the addition of the $50 million that came into the account on June 6th. So, that multiple.
Through here. The performance numbers, this is where I think performance numbers through the end of June, as you can see, if you go back 1 year and say the year to date, you can see we've had a nice incremental benefit from our management, and I'll tell you where that comes from in a minute. And then if you take a look over on page seven, this is through the end of July, and you see things start to deteriorate a little on a relative basis, and that's when you start to see people go more and more towards treasuries, which we have very few of. And then since the end of the month of July until today, and for those of you that aren't really into fixed income, this is going to be a lot, but keep in mind that you almost don't get any money if you get 3 month bills. If you want to buy a 3 month bill this morning, it was 0.0051%. Okay, so you just get your money back after 3 months if you have undercredit. If you go out 2 years, you get 20 basis points, so that's less than 40%. Speaking of perspective, if you lend it to the government $100, in 2 years you come back and you get $100 and 40 cents. So it's almost like that. For 2 years, 5 years, there's less than 1%. Now, the 10-year treasury from the end of last month until now went from 2.75%, which is not a lot of yield, down to 2.11 from this morning. And the 30-year treasury went from 4.11 to 3.44. Doesn't sound like a lot, but those are both almost 70 basis points or 0.7%, and that's a remarkable decline. And keep in mind, this is after the end of QE2, so you don't have the Fed in it, by the way, but you still have this depression in rates going on. So the yield advantage, I'll talk about that in a minute, but I think what's happened since the end of the month is a tremendous rush to treasury and an abandonment of a lot of other areas, including the areas that we're going to see. We are, and as we've always been, particularly involved in corporate credits and mortgage securities. And those spreads have opened up. The treasuries have declined. Spreads have opened up. Our levels, our return levels since the beginning of the year are about the same, maybe down 20 basis points from what you see here. But the market, as measured by the Barclays aggregate, is almost 2% higher. So we are going to lag other periods of time, but we at least understand why. If you look from a historical perspective on page 8, this is, everybody refers to this as the beginning of the crisis, which is the top blue line. And you can see that that's one of the few times that people can come to me and say, well, where are interest rates? And I can say, usually I say, well, where? Overnight rates, long rates. It didn't matter back then. It was always 5% all across the board. And yet, and the concern, the thoughts of the time, and this is a good idea about how imprecise, unable we are to see the future, the concerns of the time were that we had an overheating economy and a concern about inflation. That's where we went into this. We clearly didn't see it very well, the market in general, etc. You can see the depths of the crisis where that gold line down at the bottom, when you get down to the point where you're anchored at zero, and you have just a little over 2% for the 10-year treasury,
and just a little 2.5% for the 30-year pressure. And you can see that by the end of June, it is kind of recovered to what we're doing in much more normal level. Now, if you have to take your finger on this one, but if you go to today, and you were able to go to the 2-year, you're at 21 basis points, so 0.2%. The 10-year treasury is at 2.11, so it's probably a little bit below where that 10-year mark is. And the 30-year is at 3.44, so dramatically low. So those are the kinds of, that's the kind of environment we're going in. On page 9, this is also kind of a big picture sort of what's going on in the market in general. The top left one is helpful for us because we have such a big exposure to credit, and these are just the yield spreads or the difference in yield between these credit ratings and treasuries. There's a kind of an expanded version of this on page 41. It's a little bit easier to read. But you can see that the spreads on both a relative and absolute basis are still pretty interesting from a long-term historical perspective. Now, they're not where they were in a crisis, but they're clearly wider and more interesting than most of the other sectors. So we'll continue to remain involved there. The bottom, yes.
The pain we felt in 2008 when spreads widened was great. And looking at this chart on the upper left,
yeah.
Is there a likelihood spreads could widen significantly again with the European banking crisis playing out?
Well, I think if you go to page, certainly it started in one arena. If you go to page 41, you can see this a little bit. So we had, when we were going into this crisis, you can see when the crisis starts to raise the curve. We just didn't see, nor did the market see, those kinds of kind of exploding rates. They're starting to go wider right now in the banking arena. The lower rated banking debt is wider. That is in spite of the fact that we've got far more liquidity, greater transparency, better regulations, et cetera, with the banking system. But there's still enough fear it's starting to widen out. And there's a lot of concern. A lot of this is concern about how exposed are they to European banks. It's not all, we don't think there's that much exposure there, but there's market concern about it. So kind of, it can go wider, but I don't think you've got the liquidity concerns that really kind of came to bear here. And the companies are much more liquid. They don't need to come to the marketplace. The commercial paper market, for example, where companies go and they borrow short-term, is much different now than it used to be. A lot of these companies said, I don't want to go through that again, and they termed out their borrowing. So they borrowed out further. So I don't see this. But I see some of the spreading going on, and it's opening up that people buy up in high-level treasuries, but I don't see that kind of...
The other different problem is that it's not just liquidity is much better because the capital markets are functioning better in terms of short-term access to capital, but the capital adequacy of the banks is much better today than it was because of the fact that they've raised equity. Their capital ratios are much higher, and we've already gone through a significant downturn in the housing market. Now, there's always a chance it could go a little lower, but we think it's extremely unlikely that we would go down another 20% nationwide, which is basically what has happened in the past 3 years. So most of the major banks have actually begun to see their loan loss provisions decline. It doesn't mean that they still don't have problem loans. They do. But the delinquencies have started to come down a little bit. The loan loss provisions have started to come down. Some of the banks have actually been releasing reserves, so that would be another argument for us not seeing the kind of panic, banking crisis that we had. But I think the fears are that what's going on in Europe could spill over somehow to the U.S. That's what some of the fears are, for sure. Just as Lehman failing set off a whole chain reaction that was much broader than anyone expected.
If you go to page 10, this is just a quick attribution performance. It seems like an eon ago, but this is for the end of June. Just really quickly, I'm going to go down to relative return factors. The fact back then that we had corporate sector overweight was helpful. It has not been since. Nominal yield advantage, I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. That was helpful.
taxable municipal securities. I mentioned them to you the last time I was here. Those are the bad bonds, Build America bonds that came out of the stimulus package in 09. They performed very well. These are, you know, state of California type bonds, things like that. The shorter duration, that's technical terms of saying we have less exposure to interest rate movements. If you're concerned about higher rates, that is not going to be up very well. If you could just take a look at page 11, this is what the portfolio looks like relative to the aggregate. A couple of things to note. On the top left, those are your sectors. We have a decided underweight to treasuries. We don't think it's a terribly attractive place to be when you're talking about the kind of rates I just mentioned here. The fact that you're almost 15% there is more a reflection of the fact that the $50 million that came in, we were still investing over that period of time, because it was only about 20-something days after that came in. So right now it's about somewhere around 90%, et cetera. That's much more comfortable. We have a few the government-related, those were mostly the BAB bonds I just mentioned here. And then just two things to mention on this page. Yield to maturity down there, we have, you can see we're about 0.3%, a little more than that, higher in yield overall. Well, that is now, as of last night, that has widened out to about 77 basis points, or 0.75% higher than the aggregate right now. So those spreads, that just takes time to harvest. It comes back to you, but it just takes time. So that's, I think, very beneficial. And the duration of that should be earlier, this figure were about 80%. And then just the bottom, before I turn it back to Wendell, contribution duration, this is where is the market, where is your portfolio exposed to interest rate changes? And you can see very little change, we have very little exposure to treasuries, far less than that of the aggregate. And in fact, this time this is accentuated a little bit just because we still have the $50 million we're putting to work. And then a significant over exposure by intent in your corporate arena. So, unless there's other questions, we're running short, so I'm going to turn over to Wendell.
Okay. All right. Maybe we'll have time for a couple questions at the end. On the equity portfolio, once again, you can see on slide page 15, June 30th, seems like an eternity ago because of what's been happening. Your portfolio was valued at about $182.5 million then. As of this morning, it's about 152, just to bring you up to date. And that's reflecting roughly a 15% correction in the broad U.S. equity market in the last 1 month. In July 22nd, I think, is where it was roughly 15% higher than it is today. So that's a big, big change. So the numbers for June 3rd performance on page 16 are obviously quite out of date, but just to show you quickly, we were slightly ahead of your benchmark as of June 30th, plus 6% net of fees versus plus 5.9 for the Russell 1000 Value Index, and over the last 1 year, 200 basis points or 2 percentage points ahead of your benchmark. So I know there have been some questions in the past about our peer group ranking for equities. I'm happy to say that through June 30th, we're back in the top 35% of our peer group over the last 1 year, above the median year to date, and then just below the median for 3 years, which is still being held back a bit by what happened to us, as you know, in 08 and 09, when we had a tough period through the early part of 09. But those long-term numbers put us very much at the top of our peer group over the last decade. Page 17 shows you an update through July. The equity market was starting to turn down in July after rallying at the end of June. Once again, as I said, kind of herky-jerky. You can see we were down 3.8%, a little bit more than your benchmark, and that brought us a little below for the year-to-date, but still ahead over a one-year time frame. And July has just been, you know, incredibly volatile, as I said. Slide 18, I think, is interesting in that it provides a contrast to the weakness in the equity markets that has taken place in the last couple months, because corporate earnings have continued to be very strong through the second quarter. In spite of the fears that people have looking forward, the second quarter for the S&P 500, earnings were up about 15%, and sales were up more than 10%. So if you and worried about where the economy is heading, it was not showing up through the second quarter. There's always a few exceptions with certain companies, but that is for the aggregate of the largest companies in the U.S. And one question I've had from people is, how could their earnings have been so strong given the GDP was not very strong? Keep in mind that between 40 to 50% of the sales of the S&P 500 companies come from outside the U.S., where developing markets and some other parts of the world are continuing to grow pretty strongly. And U.S. companies have been very cautious about hiring people back in this recovery. It's one of the things that's actually holding the recovery back. But it's also one of the things that has allowed their profits to be as strong, because they have been pretty cautious in terms of their commitments. So it's really almost a disconnect at this point between what's happening in the market, which is always forward-looking, and there are concerns that we're heading down, perhaps, but actually quite strong corporate profits. There's a lot of detail on your year-to-date performance on pages 19, 20, and 21. I'm actually not going to go through it in a lot of detail, because given what's happened since then, it's a little bit irrelevant. But I guess the high points would be that we've had relatively good stock selection in the financials area, and we're underweighted significantly compared to your benchmark. That helped you year to date and over the past year. Those are the two biggest, the biggest positive over both those time periods. And then being overweighted in the consumer discretionary area, which is largely media names that we hold, has also helped you, because that has been one of the strongest areas of the market, once again, pre-June 30th. And a lot has changed since then. If you flip forward to page 22, you can see where the portfolio was as of June 30th. And I'll tell you a few things that we've been doing since then, but you can see the darkest shaded blue bar in each of these sectors is your weighting, and then the other two are the S&P 500 in the middle of each sector, that bar, and then the Russell 1000 Dow Index, which is your benchmark. So you can see on the left-hand side of the page, the largest sectors of your portfolio were technology and healthcare. And then followed by financials, but you can see once again there that comment that I made just a minute ago, how underweighted we are compared to that value index weighting in financials. We have been nibbling and selectively adding to a few financials names since June 30th. It's been one of the weakest areas of the market. We think there are some very good values there, but we're doing it cautiously and selectively. Tech has not helped us much this year, to be honest with you. It's been one of the weaker areas. We think there are some exceptional values there, and there's a chart that I have in my briefcase that shows on a kind of a forward price-to-earnings basis, technology, the top 1,500 technology companies in the U.S. market are at an all-time low valuation today relative to the rest of the S&P industrials. So you are not paying a premium to own technology today. And one of the longer-term themes that we think is still very much true today is the pace of technological change remains pretty rapid. There's all kinds of evidence of that. The other big one would be the developing world, what's going on in emerging markets, which has been part of the reason why U.S. multinationals have been able to do better than what U.S. GDP might indicate. So those are the larger sectors of the portfolio. One other thing I want to mention just here on this page before we wrap up and keep to your half hour is that valuations were, you can see in our portfolio, about 11 times forward earnings as of June 30th, compared to about 13.5 for the S&P 500. Those numbers today would be about 9.5 times forward earnings, compared to 11.5 for the S&P. So these are very low multiples of earnings that are projected for this year, which tells you a couple things. One is maybe people don't believe those earnings are really going to be achieved in the second half of the year. We know they were achieved in the first half, but if we are at a tipping point and consumer confidence has been coming down, it looks like business confidence has been shaken also by perhaps some of the changes in Washington that we've seen. So there's a lot of skepticism, and investors are not paying a high multiple for those projected earnings today. To us, that says that perhaps, given how low those multiples seem to be, the equity markets have discounted, at least in my opinion, a mild recession already. And a more serious downturn like what we went through before, of course, that's probably not in stock prices today, and we don't think we're going to have another one of those. But a mild recession, I think, has been discounted already, and you know, there's an old saying, and once again, we don't have a crystal ball that's better than anyone else's, but the stock market has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. You know, it predicted one a year ago also, and we did not have one. This may be different this year because it does look like the momentum has clearly slowed down in the U.S. and Europe is not a lot better. But the good thing is that valuations are not high right now. So the starting point is a lot of skepticism already built in. So if companies can muddle through and the second half of the year is a little better even than people think, equities should do pretty well. And it's a challenging environment for us with the volatility because there's really nothing in your portfolio that we want to sell, and we don't have analysts coming in and saying, we think it's time to sell this stock because it's too expensive. There's just not much that looks expensive at all today. But what we've been doing as a policy committee is one stock at a time, which is the way our process works at Dodge & Cox, where we are doing the research on each company, trying to understand its opportunities and its risks, and look at its valuation. And that's what drives our process all the time, every day at Dodge & Cox, is we are forcing ourselves as a policy committee to say, you know what, we really don't want to sell that stock, but we think we have one over here, like Microsoft, that we've bought this year, which is the largest new purchase in your portfolio this year, that's trading at less than 10 times earnings, and we've never owned it before. We still think it's one of the premier software companies in the world. So we have to force ourselves to say, you know, that other idea, it's still a good idea, but it's not maybe one of our best ideas today. So we're selling some names, we're trimming back some names that we otherwise wouldn't in a more normal set of conditions. And those are tough decisions because the analyst is not leading the charge to sell, and we have to kind of push to make sure we're giving you the best portfolio we can. The names appear, and I want to wrap up to be respectful of your time, but the names in your portfolio appear on page 23. And we don't have time to go through those, but TMT, which is more broad than just technology, you can see is the largest when we combine those media names that I mentioned with telecom and technology, 37% of your portfolio. Within technology, slide 24 shows you we have broad diversification across all areas, including hardware and software. We've never really been overweighted in software before at Dodge & Cox, but that is the case today. Something very, very different. And just to wrap up, on 25, financials, I've mentioned we're underweighted there, but we are adding selectively to some names like Charles Schwab, like Bank of New York Mellon and BB&T that are, we think are solid financials with good capital to absorb some additional stress if that comes. It's actually been going the other way where provisions for losses have been coming down, but if they tick up again, capital is much better and valuations are really, really depressed in this part of the market. So with that, I think I'm just going to wrap up. There's a few more general comments that I could make, but I want to make sure if there are a couple questions that we have time for.
I had one. I noticed that Hewlett-Packard was your largest weight. And you still own that?
We do. It's it took a pretty good hit last week on some news that they lowered their earnings guidance. It's an amazing situation today because we think the stock is extremely oversold. And I don't use that word very often, but we would say extremely in the case of HP. Even on the company's sort of lowered earnings guidance that they gave last week, at the current stock price, it's trading at about 5 times this year's earnings in a market that is maybe 11.5 times. So there's a lot of skepticism in HP. They announced an expensive acquisition of a software company called Autonomy. There seems to have been a negative reaction to that because it was a pretty high-priced deal. But we don't believe that Hewlett Packard is broken at all. We've had conversations in the last 2 days with their CEO, their CFO, and their chairman of the board, who's a non-executive chairman, and providing some of our own feedback. They're going across the country right now, meeting with investors, trying to explain this change in strategy. They're putting more of an emphasis on software and services. And the PC division, which contributes about 14% of their profits. And so, actually, there's been a lot of pressure on the company to do that. So you would have thought maybe there would have been a positive reaction to it, that they're now going to go pursue that possibility. But I think they misjudged what the reaction would be. And
there was a small vocal group that was interested in the PC market.
They've actually done a great job at their PC business over the last 5 to 7 years, taking market share away from Dell. They're the leader in the industry. They've actually raised margins. They're profitable there. But the one area where you could say they have missed the current trend, if you want to call it that, is tablet computers. And they did throw in the towel on their tablet. And Apple, of course, is leading the charge there. So PC market isn't growing as fast as it used to, especially on the consumer side. But on the enterprise side, businesses are not abandoning their PCs at this point. So.
What about the overall market? There's been a lot of talk about the average person getting out of the market. Has the market itself changed? Do you see it changing in the next couple of years?
Well, I think the memories of 08 and 09 are still fresh enough in people's minds in terms of the crisis that we went through and the money that was lost, and we're still not back to where we were. So that people, we see it a little bit in terms of flows from our mutual funds. Actually, we thought there would have been more significant outflows from our funds, and we've seen the industry data, and July was not a good month. Mutual funds saw significant outflows. Ours were much more modest. But I do think that people are lacking some confidence right now. And it's interesting because it seems that if you just go back over the last month or two and say, what really tipped the scale? The debt ceiling debate, or debacle, whatever you want to call it, in Washington seems to have really shaken people's confidence in our government's leaders, for one thing. And the possibility that we're going to have to see some significant cuts in government spending, which longer term you would say is probably a good thing in terms of getting our fiscal house in order. But shorter term, that stimulus to the economy has helped. Some people would debate how much it's helped, but if you take away $1.5 trillion of federal deficit spending, that's 10% of our GDP, roughly 9 to 10% of our GDP. There's no way that could have gone to zero overnight, because it would have been a disaster for our country. So we knew that the debt ceiling debate would be resolved one way or another. Because it had to be. But now the question is, how will the two very opposed sort of political sides come to an agreement? And there's this super committee, and if they can't agree, and it's hard to say how they agree, and how dug in people were, and the leaders of each party have picked the representatives for the super committee, so you can get a pretty good idea of it's going to be tough. Then, automatic cuts will kick in if they don't agree by certain dates, and so I think there's a lot of fear about that right now.
Can you see the market going up without the consumer getting that boost?
Well, the consumer is getting a boost right now from lower oil prices. That's one thing that people point to as sort of weaker consumer spending more recently might have been tied to the higher oil prices. that, you know, was a tax on the consumer, they're not getting a tax refund back because the price of oil amounts. It's not coming down at the pump as fast as the actual price of oil is coming down. But that could happen over time. I think the president and the administration is looking at extending the jobless benefits and the payroll tax cut, which is actually a meaningful to GDP if it's not extended next year, so there's a lot of pressure there. So the consumer spending did rebound a little bit in July, but through June was weak. But you know, it's hard with GDP being 70% consumer spending. It's hard for the economy to grow much if consumer spending is not growing just a little bit.
But you're still thinking about the demand.
Well, valuations just look low, really low. So, you know, we'll see. We're talking to companies. The other interesting thing that's been true, we've met with the CEOs and CFOs of several big companies in the last couple weeks, is they don't see any significant change in their business yet. Some of the economic data does show that. But through the second quarter and into July, you know, we've been asking questions. Are you seeing order rates change dramatically? Are you seeing trends deteriorate dramatically? I have not talked to one company yet that has said that they've seen that. But when you look at the consumer confidence numbers, it tells you the consumer is definitely not as confident. I mean, that there were some very good numbers, I think, last week. So we'll see if it comes. I mean, the retail sales were actually okay in July. August may be very different. You know, it's too early to tell, but I would have to agree, you know, the mood out there has definitely darkened in the last month. And we'll have to see whether that flows through the consumer spending or not.
What is the likely effect of the Fed freezing the interest rate at such a low, practically zero?
For the next 2 years.
And they said they're going to keep it there. So you can aim it at the short end of zero for the next 2 years. What they're trying to do is make cash be trash. They're trying to get people to outspend fundamentally.
Do what?
Cash be trash. In other words, they don't want the Fed. That's crazy. In other words, if you put your money in cash, it's not really worth it. If you put 3-month bills, all you need is your money back. Okay, so why don't you go out and spend some of the money? They're going to try and keep the cost of doing business low as they can. And you look at the liquidity in the bank, it's immense. And the liquidity in the banking system within the Fed, there's more cash and money there. But the people are not spending. They don't want to spend. So that's how they're going to keep it there low enough, as low as they can, for as long as they can, as long as they need to. Now, there's this talk about QE3 coming down the pipe. And I'm not quite sure where that takes them and what they can do. I mean, rates are incredibly low right now. Think about when this recent decline in rates has occurred. It's after the end of QE2, when the Fed stopped buying. So there's, that's one of the other concerns that Glenn and Juan were talking about, is that there's some concern about whether the Fed has run out of bullets. And they can keep the rates low, but as they can do it, but unknown.
In theory, there should be another wave of refinancing of mortgages as long as you can qualify. And there are a number of people that are underwater on their homes who can't qualify, or they don't have a job, they can't qualify. So I'm helping one of our individual clients right now refinance her mortgage. The banks are pretty busy looking for new loans for people who can do it, because we'll see if this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but, you know, with a 30-year mortgage at 4.1%, I think, is what
all of Matt said. I remember when I started the business, my first mortgage was at 12. And I went up higher than that.
It's under 4.5, depending on the points.
Yeah, and whether you're paying a point.
Right. No points, it's 4.5.
It's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
Should that force people into things like utilities, and what's your position on utilities?
We don't have any utilities right now. That's another, you know, area that's viewed as somewhat of a safe haven in the equity market. Dividend-paying stocks become more attractive, I think, to investors.
But it's not an area you have anything in or believe in.
We just don't think they are a good value today, given that they have been stronger than other areas of the market. There are lots of good companies that we've owned in the utility area. It's not a big area of the market either. But dividends are increasing. This year, I think the number that I just read was S&P 500 companies have raised their dividends 10% in aggregate this year. So as those corporate earnings have been strong, companies are paying higher dividends again and repurchasing shares. So we look at that's another way that they can return cash to shareholders. Microsoft pays about a 2.5% dividend. Which is higher than the 10-year treasury.
I was just going to go there. I was going to say, now, if you look at the aggregate, is about all the bonds that are out there are somewhere in the low 2% kind of rates. So now all of a sudden you start to layer in the opportunity on the equity side. That's in the 30s, 40s, 50s, I think that equities actually out-yielded bonds because it's going back to that advice.
And here's another anecdote that's just amazing. Coca-Cola, which is one of our great U.S. multinational companies, we don't have in our portfolio, but just as an example, several weeks ago issued 5-year bonds yielding 1.8%. Coca-Cola's dividend is 2.8%, and they have raised their dividend on average 10% every year for the last 10 years.
And why wouldn't you think that is good?
It is good.
But you don't have...
Oh, we don't have Coca-Cola.
No, we think the stock price is too high in relation to their earnings. But there are other examples like that in our portfolio that we're looking very closely at today. So I'm just using it as an anecdote to say, as an investor or a saver, would you like to lock in a 1.8% bond yield for the next 5 years? And it's a great company. They'll pay you back. I can almost guarantee you Coca-Cola will pay you back in 5 years. But you can also get their dividend if you buy their stock.
So you have to worry the stock's going to go down.
And the stock could go down. That's the risk that you're taking. Right. But they have raised that dividend 10% a year for the last 10 years, and their earnings continue to grow. So Microsoft would be a good example of a company where we think that dividend is likely to grow over time, and they're probably going to repurchase a lot of stock.
Will Bank of America become private?
Bank of America is one of the tough ones in the market right now as a major bank. We think it is a bargain. We actually started a very small position in it as of the end of the second quarter, and we've been adding to it again recently. But there are all kinds of rumors going on. There was a rumor today that J.P. Morgan is going to buy Bank of America. I think that's just a rumor, but I've learned in the last 3 years that you cannot discount something. The company believes they do not need to issue any new capital, and they've been adamant about that all along. So, they have issues for sure, but it is by far the cheapest of the big banks already. It trades at about one half of its book value. And actually, that is one half of its tangible book. So that's writing off all the goodwill and saying the goodwill from things like Countrywide, which is their worst nightmare right now, is worthless. But Wells Fargo and Capital One are the two largest financials that we have by far, and they don't have nearly the same issues that we have.
Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Sorry we've gone over, but it does seem like there's some questions. One thing I can guarantee you is Wells Fargo and Capital One do not have a single dollar of exposure to the so-called PIGs. Absolutely zero. And yet, they're going down in this market down the track too. So it's just fascinating to see that.
How concerned are you folks about the European debt issues, and where do you see that going in the short term?
We really have virtually minuscule exposure in our domestic portfolio. We have more in our international stock fund, which you don't use. I think it's clearly a concern, and the issue is not so much Greece because Greece won't take down all of Europe, but as this so-called contagion has been spreading to Spain and Italy, those are two much bigger economies, right. And then the fact that the German and the French banks have exposure to Spain, big exposure to Spain and Italy. And this is the part that Bob mentioned is, you don't know exactly how much exposure they have. They've given you some reading on it. We don't, by the way, don't own any Spanish or any French or German banks in our national stock at all. But
haven't they loaned about 140 billion euros to Greece?
The French and German banks?
They just
banks?
Did, about 140. Yeah.
The ECB has been pretty active in making loans to Greece to keep them going.
To a 38 billion euro economy.
Yeah. So the more prosperous, stronger northern European economies have been really helping out the southern, weaker neighbors. And Greece, is trading like it's already defaulted on their debt. But the bigger issue is really Spain and Italy, because there's much, much more exposure there.
Do you see the EU being able to sustain this and stay together?
That's a great question. I mean, I don't think we have a crystal ball that's better than anybody else on that. But the problem is you have a monetary union, but you don't have a fiscal union. And so coordinating the response and the disagreements between the French and the Germans is there, every day. And they can't agree, on how they should help.
That scares me somewhat.
Yeah. So, whether that results in another worldwide banking crisis remains to be seen. But we know that the larger financial positions in our portfolio, hold for you, do not have exposure there. There's been concern about the money market funds in the U.S. that have had some short-term paper in European banks. Bob can maybe comment on that.
We actually sent around a note to our clients that were not in Treasury or government funds. None of the money market funds have any significant European banks. Why expose yourself to that? We recommend that they look at Treasury and government funds. And so I think we've seen a number of articles there lately. Because a lot of the money market funds have significant exposure to European banks.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we'll move on to item 7, semi-annual performance report by PIMCO.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me up here today. It's always a pleasure to come up and visit with you all. As fate would have it, just this last week I was in the neighborhood. I was taking my family to vacation in Yosemite. So on the way back, I thought briefly about just deviating and staying in Modesto for yesterday, but they needed to get back to lunchtime. So I'm now making kind of a round trip back up here, and it's good to be with all of you. By way of introduction, my name is Matt Clark. I'm your primary contact at PIMCO. I work very closely with another colleague of mine. Her name is Mariko Boswell. Mariko's not here with me today because she's in the process of relocating to New York. She'll still continue to work with me on the account, but just happened to be this week is the week that she's moving. So I thought it'd be best to let her focus on that and talk to you by myself. I had a chance to visit with the board last year. We had a very robust discussion about increasing investment discretion, and for the most part, we haven't really been employing that because more recently we've been very concerned with the risk posture in the market. So while we very much appreciate having an additional investment discretion that the board extended to us, and we anticipate using that to a more full extent in the months and years ahead, the portfolio has performed well in large part because we've been very conservative in our approach to the capital markets, and that's been reflected in performance. Before I get going with my prepared remarks in terms of how the portfolio has performed and our economic outlook, and perhaps an update, let me just pause for a minute and find out what's top of mind for all of you, and also, importantly, what you need me to do in terms of keeping the group on schedule. My time is your time. I'm not controlling that. But if you'd like me to focus on a particular amount of time to cover remarks, I'll do my best to do that.
You just go through your report and take the time that you need. I don't have to be somewhere till 6 o'clock.
So the importance is, especially if
spend less time on the past performance and more giving the firm and its widespread views what you feel, how you feel Europe's going to play out, and the new normal. Are we a bump in the new normal or a recession?
Well, I think that's a great agenda, and that's where I'll focus on the go-forward outlook. I thought Wendell and Bob did a very nice job of covering what's been happening in the market, so I won't walk you through all that. But if you'll turn with me to page 2, I do want to point out at least one thing that's a bit retroactive. At the top of page 2, you'll see that we have a table there that highlights the key points of our outlook at the start of this year. So as we came into this year, we were expecting to see very different growth rates between the developed countries like the United States and Europe and the developing countries, places like Asia and Latin America. We also expected that a lot of asset class returns would be very much influenced by policy response. So at the beginning of the year, we actually had some favorable policy measures, and that payroll tax credit 2% was very helpful to the broader risk markets. And to the extent that those policy measures could be carried forward, we expected them to be supportive of riskier assets. Now, as Bob and Wendell mentioned, that policy response has been very uneven, to say the least, and perhaps the best example is the debt ceiling debate. But that's been a significant component to what's been going on in the market. And at the beginning of the year, we expected the Treasury market to face a lot of pressure because the Federal Reserve had been the primary buyer of Treasuries. They telegraphed the market quite far in advance that it was going to stop doing that in June. And since they were the primary buyer, we thought that their prices would naturally fall as that buyer stepped away from the market. You know, I would say the first two areas I point out to you are our views have more or less played out, but in this last respect, the expectation that Treasury prices would fall and yields would rise was absolutely incorrect. The Treasury market has gone exactly the opposite direction in terms of what we've expected. And I bring up that point just to say very candidly that as an active manager, there's going to be times that where you simply don't get the return environment right, or a sector of the environment right. Our goal, though, is to build portfolios that are very diverse so that if we get any one, say, position wrong, that you will still perform well. And I think that approach is different from other folks who rely predominantly on one sector of the market to generate excess returns. And you'll see that diversification benefit played out in terms of performance as we go through that. Just briefly on how the portfolio's performed, we've been fortunate to manage just over $80 million on our behalf since May of 2010. Again, we very much appreciate the business that you trusted with us. We understand that these were retirement assets for the participants and retirees of Stanislaus County. We appreciate the question placed. If you drop down to the table at the bottom, the large table is data through June, which as we know, is not particularly relevant. If you go to the far right-hand column where it says year-to-date, the portfolio has returned 5% on a before-fee basis and 4.8% after fees. That's outperforming the benchmark by about 40 basis points on a net-of-fee basis year-to-date. If we were to run the numbers through this month, current month-to-date, the portfolio has basically kept up with the index. And by the way, I'm sorry, I'm on page 6. The index has returned about 2% this month, and your portfolio is very close to that. The index has returned 1.86% month to date. The portfolio has returned just over 1.9%. If we were to go back to the very inception of the account through July, your portfolio has returned 7.33%, so from May of 2010 through July of 2011. 7.33% on a before fee, 7.04% on after fee, and the index return just under 6%. So some meaningful outperformance over this time period that we've been with, and we hope to continue that going forward, of course. Page 7, very briefly, depicts how we're structuring the portfolio, and I haven't spent a great deal of time here in light of wanting to focus on our go-forward outlook. The top left corner shows you how we're positioned from an interest rate standpoint, and the bottom bar charts depict which sectors of the broad bond market we're investing in. And the way that this has changed since June is we've actually brought the interest rate sensitivity of the portfolio closer to that index in light of our concerns with the prospect for economic growth. And on the margin, we've been looking to pull back on risk in the portfolio because we don't feel that the full range of potential outcomes has been adequately priced into the market, particularly for risk assets. And I would say that's one area in which we disagree maybe with the folks from Dodge and Cox. The equity market may have priced in a mild recession. We don't think it's pricing the potential for something more severe at this point. And that same pricing dynamic is extending to places like high yield and maybe to extend investment. Let me pause for just a minute. I went through the performance very quickly. Again, in summary, relatively good performance news on both an absolute and a relative basis, which provide important diversification in terms of the most recent challenges. I'm going to shift into our expectations for the economic outlook on a longer term and a shorter term basis. But before I do that, let me just see if there are any questions on the account's performance. Well, if you'll turn with me to page 9. And Paul, your question of kind of where we are in this dynamic of the new normal that we discussed in the past. On page 9, what we present to you is our longer-term, 3 to 5 year economic outlook. And really, it's been consistent for the last couple of years that we expected this to be the case to play out over the next several years. And at the heart of our longer-term economic outlook is this really strong tension between what's happening in the developed world, places like the United States, and the growth dynamics in the developing world. Now, in the developed world, lots of growth challenges, many of which are becoming increasingly structural in nature. And for that reason, we don't expect U.S. economic growth to get much above that 2% threshold on a real basis. If we shift to the developing world, we have a much more optimistic view of the ability of their economies to grow and the people in the middle class to have their incomes go up. But there are certain risks within that scenario. What we will have to do on their behalf is over the next 3 to 5 years is navigate this world that has very different speeds in terms of the way different economies are performing and the way inflation is playing across the globe. And that's important because if you look down to page 10, one of the things that we've been talking about is just the very wide range of outcomes we are dealing with over the next 3 to 5 years. Now, it's not all doom and gloom, right? There is a positive potential for the world economy. And that positive potential will rely on policymakers the world over getting together and striking what we term as grand bargains. So a good example in the United States would be in regards to the debt ceiling. If we could get the political leaders to enact the type of grand bargain in terms of tax increases and spending cuts that would put the country on a more favorable fiscal footing in the intermediate to longer term, that would be something that the market would probably greet very well and be very positive for the broader economy and positive for financial assets. We could say the same sort of grand bargain playing out potentially in Europe, where Germany and France are come to disagreements and essentially allow the core of the European area to backstop the debt obligations of the peripheral places like Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy, Greece, those places. That's kind of the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that we're stuck with these very significant imbalances where policymakers can't get together, like with the debt ceiling. And places like Germany and France continue to have very public disagreements about the best course forward in Europe. Those are the kind of the extremes. Where do we land? Well, we expect over the next 3 to 5 years and in the current environment to be more of a muddle through where we have this sort of patchwork series of agreements that really don't provide the structural relief that we need to see good economic growth, but don't necessarily force us in to the very severe contraction that we experienced in 2008 and 2009. So that muddled growth sort of story is very much the kind of key conclusion of the new normal. And the reason we call it a new normal is because if you look at economies coming out of a period of severe economic contraction like what we've been through, typically they rebound with very strong economic growth. We don't think that that's going to play out in this case because of the structural dynamics that we've been discussing. Now, the investment implications of this is page 11. As we think about constructing portfolios, we think you have to be very mindful of these longer-term dynamics. And
there are four primary conclusions that we come to in terms of thinking about how do we structure a bond portfolio on the back. In a world where we expect growth in the developed world to be lower and more challenged than what we would see in the past, we want to look for areas of the bond market that offer better yields, safer yields than what we might traditionally have been associated with treasury yields. And you know, current round's a good example. Treasury's at roughly 2% for the 10-year. Are there other areas of the market that we can exploit that offer stable and safe yields that allow you to earn a rate of return that's over inflation? So if we were to look at the headline level of inflation, it's at 3.6%, core levels about 2%. If you lock up the money in the treasury, you effectively are no better off in terms of your efficiency. So where can we go in the bond market to source yields that are going to be safe and stable, but give us a return that's better than what we see in inflation? We're also going to have to look to, on the third line down, target areas that we think are strong initial conditions. So as we look to lend money to different areas of the globe, we want to be mindful of lending to areas that we think have good balance sheets and good conditions to pay ourselves. We pay you for the money that you're lending. Now, in the Standard Serve portfolio, we have, you know, that is expressed through a very small operation or loan to the Canadian government. It's in a much better fiscal position. An example of how we'll look to other areas of the globe to take interest rate exposure that's more attractive than what we might be able to get here in the United States. And then we think more broadly that you have to be very mindful about traditional asset allocation and really think hard about how do you build diversification into the broader portfolio. And so to be very mindful of strategies that perform well when the equity market's performing well and perform poorly when the equity market performs poorly. Try and build things in there that will perform well when the market is not doing well as it is currently. Now, on a near-term basis, if we drop down, you know, what does that mean in terms of portfolio positioning? As we look across the entire spectrum, we think there's a lot of opportunities outside of the treasury market in places like municipal securities, select corporate securities, to source additional portfolio yield, and you see that reflected in the way the portfolio is structured currently. So if we go back to page 7, so if you look across the entire deal, what we constructed is a very high quality portfolio that does have fair exposure to government securities in light of the uncertainty in the near-term environment. But it has some interesting off-index positions in municipal securities, in dollar-denominated emerging market debt, which is consistent with our longer-term economic outlook. And then within corporate securities, we actually like financial sector issuers, even though they've been having a rough go of it lately in the bond market. We do concur that the U.S. financial system is in much better shape than Europe, and it's a good place to lend money to in light of increased transparency, regulatory oversight, and ultimately more bond-friendly policies that we have. When you distill all of that down, you end up with a portfolio that outlooks the index by roughly 0.5%. So the index is yielding in the neighborhood of 2.5 to 3%. Your portfolio is yielding 3 to 3.5%. Now, we could reach for additional yield, but we think this is an environment where you want to avoid doing that because on a near-term basis, the range of potential outcomes is very, very wide. The way we talk about it internally is we list four different scenarios for the next 12 months. This first scenario, scenario A, where we have a very strong rebound, consistent with what you get after typical deep recessions. Scenario B is the same sort of strong rebound that takes longer to arrive. Scenario C is this very unsatisfying world that we're living in, 1 to 2% growth that sticks around for a while. And scenario D is outright recession's contraction, a double-dip recession. When we started the year, we were sort of in the C plus B minus group. Over the last several months, in light of the policy challenges that we've been through, our evaluation has moved much more into the C minus B plus camp as a potential for the U.S. economy for over the next 12 months. And so in light of that, we have to be very sensitive to the amount of risk that we put in the portfolio and have to pull back on those risk exposures in order to prove. One of the topics that you highlighted and has been an area of interest is Europe, what's happening in Europe. And I think that really kind of echoes a lot of things that's happening in the United States, right? So we have this very public spat between the U.S., I'm sorry, between Germany and France. You know, we think the base case is the euro remains intact. We think eventually we're going to see increasing guarantees from the core of Europe, particularly Germany, to the peripherals. The way that would manifest itself was a euro bond program. If that were to happen, on the margin, we'd be more interested in the because where German yields are right now, they'd be too low on a weighted average basis if they're guaranteeing that these other peripheral countries converge. Yeah. That they would converge, yeah, if a euro bond program was to be put forward. What's been very interesting, though, is that how that plays out, how long it takes to get here, could cause quite a bit of market volatility and then further pressure on financial assets. And one way we've seen that play out most recently is that, you know, we had Greece falling apart, and then that sort of migrated to Spain, and that's really, that and the debt ceiling debate was really what accelerated the recent weakness in the equity market and the broader markets. What stopped the Italy and Spain borrowing costs from going up from where they were heading was the ECB stepped in and very aggressively said, we will buy Italian and Spanish government debt as a way of ending this contagion. Oddly enough, they've effectively more or less pegged those interest rates in the neighborhood of 5%, which is still relatively high. And that's left France to be the one country that's sort of the free-floating interest rate environment. And so now we're seeing some odd dynamics in France where the spread for French government bonds is being affected as we get adverse news coming out of the European zone on economic development. And the reason I bring that up is it really kind of highlights some of the challenges that policymakers are facing. Right? They do this thing for Italy and Spain to stop the contagion there, and then the market just sort of looks around and says, okay, well, where's the next shoe that we can basically go to express our displeasure about the fiscal situation in Europe. They don't really want to do that in Germany because Germany's fiscal position is actually relatively good. France is kind of the next dirty shirt relative to the other dirty shirts, and so we're seeing some pressure there. And those sorts of trade-offs and costs are going to be really part of the policy-making dilemma that's going forward, and that's one of the reasons we think that as you go forward with the rest of the year, you have to be very concerned about the risk environment. Because those same sort of costs and trade-offs that we see in Europe, we're going to see playing out here in the United States. Right, so we have the Fed Chairman, Mr. Bernanke, who's going to be talking to us on the 26th after the Jackson Hole retreat. The market's expecting him to come in and say, look, we still have policy tools, but you know, the kind of the limitations on what he can do right now are much, much greater than what he could do at the start of the financial crisis. And that same dynamic is applying on a fiscal sense. So you know, the President and others would love to come forward with a very aggressive stimulus program to help the unemployment problem we have in the country. But the fiscal environment, the political environment, makes doing that very, very difficult. So we have these very difficult trade-offs and very difficult policy decisions in the near term, both in Europe and the United States. We think that's going to be the defining characteristic of our environment over the remainder of the year. It's going to be persistent headwinds in financial markets, and in light of that, we want to structure a portfolio that again is relatively conservative on risk and hopefully provides the returns that you need if other areas of the portfolio aren't performing as well as you'd like. Now, I've given you folks enough of information. I hope not too quickly. I can go on and on as my wife reminds me. So let me just pause for a minute. And find out what sort of comments or questions you have.
You don't have any questions?
Well, if I could close by once again thanking you for the trust.
I think we might have one. I do have a question. What effect, I mean, we just read recently that they laid off like 2,500 government employees in Fresno County.
Right.
And if you extrapolate that to the rest of the state and the country, it's a significant number. So what effect is that having on the overall economy and markets?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that helped after the financial crisis was the government sector, on a temporary basis, was able to step in and actually provide sources of employment. That dynamic has gone away, so that marginal bit of support isn't there for the economy in the current weakness. And so that effect is a very negative effect on the absolute level of unemployment, because firms aren't being aggressive in hiring.
But which will probably show up in next month's figures.
Right. We think, you know, that the unemployment, we're not going to see a big, necessarily a big spike in unemployment numbers, but what you're not going to see is you're not going to see a contraction in unemployment as you'd expect, given how far away we are from the trough of the last recession. You know, we really should be growing payrolls in the neighborhood of 150,000 jobs per month just to keep the unemployment rate steady. And as you all know, the number of new jobs our economy is being consistently at right at that or just below that. And the dynamic of the public sector is not going to help that. You layer on top of that the challenges that we're having from the policy response and the reluctance of firms to engage in aggressive hiring. We don't really see the unemployment situation improving in the near term. And for that reason, we look at unemployment, which most folks would say, well, that's a lagging indicator, that's a lagging indicator. To the degree that unemployment dynamic becomes more structural in nature, becomes a more forward-looking indicator in terms of what sort of activity we can expect going forward. So the short answer to your question is it's absolutely a headwind. It's a headwind to both unemployment level and economic level. And we don't really see at the state or at the federal level a great deal of fiscal flexibility to do anything to address that. Now, like that's kind of the base case. The optimistic case is that the leadership at the state and federal level gets together and says, you know, right in the intermediate to long term, we have a very significant fiscal problem that we need to address. But in the short to intermediate term, we have a very challenging set in terms of the employment situation. So let's design policies that address both. If our political leaders were to come to that sort of agreement, that would be very, very positive. It's probably what should happen.
Thank you.
In the last page, you're giving us non-investment grade holdings. Is it too simplistic to say that's where our risk is?
No, thank you for bringing that. It's on page 15. Thank you for bringing that up. That is definitely a source of risk. One of the reasons I put that in there is to kind of help with you'll see at the very bottom, they close to just 100%. So that's just the worst case scenario that they all default. Well, what would that imply? It would imply that your portfolio would 100% benchmark by about 1%. So this is a case where we will put things that we think are attractively priced into the portfolio, but we're going to size those positions in ways that we think are very conservative and responsible and consistent with kind of the environment we have. So really the reason I put this in here is that you folks were good enough to extend the investment discretion to us. I wanted to let you know that we are using it on your selective basis, but this is in a case where you've extended it to us and you've been on hog wild.
So this is an area you can watch.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that would be. Now, I would say that this isn't the only risk in the portfolio, right? I mean,
simple item,
right? We are taking interest rate risk. We're taking risk in terms of where we're investing in the maturity spectrum. You know, ultimately, the risk that you run is that our expectations for the marketplace prove to be incorrect and we position the portfolio incorrectly. For your portfolio, that has not been the case. For other portfolios at PIMCO, you know, Paul mentioned that we've been very vocal about being underweight the treasury market. And in some other portfolios, we were much more underweight the treasury market than we've been in Stan Sarah's portfolio, where we've been more conservative in the implementation of our strategies. Now, in those other strategies, we're having just an awful month, quite frankly. I mean, I've been with the firm 9 years. Yeah, it's 9 years. And even during the depths of the crisis, I can't remember where we had such a challenging month in terms of some of our kind of more marquee strategies. So, you know, I'll be the first to tell you that we never always get it all right. And there's sometimes when the market really doesn't agree with us on a short-term basis. We do try and do things, though, that add diversification so that we minimize the downside.
some of our very public pronouncements fall have been, I mean, not just off, but way off. And treasury market has really been perhaps the best example. It's been very uncooperative in terms of what we expected to get started. Ken, thank you for your time. Thank you for your business. Easy to get a hold of me. Paul knows how to track me down. He's a great job for your supplier. If you have any questions or concerns, please send them to the club tomorrow. I hope the rest of the day goes well for you.
Okay, we will move to item 8, CG Investment Solutions. Paul?
We're going to start with the quarterly report ending June 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year. And as was said by Dr. Thomas, a lot of the questions since June 30th, but we'll quickly go through this, do the monthly for July, and talk a little bit more about what's going on in the market since then. Starting on page 1 of the quarterly report, we see the first bullet point about world economy, and the U.S., the GDP was 1.3% in the second quarter, and first quarter was revised down to 0.4%, and the those numbers came out after June 30th, and I think is the primary reason why the equity markets have sold off, just from the slowdown in growth and the evidence that we might be in a recession right now. This was also said, Fed funds target rates of 0 to 0.25%. The Fed has come out and said through mid-2013, those rates will stay at that level, which was a curious announcement, to say the least. I've been facing short-term interest rate policy on the calendar rather than the economic environments. And the last bullet point on the European sovereign debt, obviously that's the second primary reason why markets have sold off, and that's been talked about by the two previous presenters. Pages 2 and 3, the performance summary for the quarter. The fund did return a positive 1%, beating its policy index by 10 basis points. And you can see what helped was a number of factors. Some of them were index funds, points 1, 2, and 4, all index funds. The good news is Delaware has started to really outperform these last couple months on a relative basis to the large cap growth. Dodge & Cox equity was up 70 basis points for the quarter, and Legato, which had been struggling, was up 200 basis points for the quarter. Invesco point 11 was up 90 basis points, showing good absolute and relative performance. And the one factor that hurt was Dodge & Cox fixed income down 30 basis points as spreads started to stop narrowing and started to widen a bit. Their short treasury and long corporate position hurt them a bit. Page 4, the fund ended the quarter just above $1.4 billion. And page 5, we list out a transition cash of $20 million on the bottom. That was the $10 million taken from each LSV and Pyramus right at the end of the quarter that was in the process of being wiring out to research affiliates long shorts. Pages 6 and 7, the performance summary. You can see that the fiscal year of 22.9 for the total fund versus 21.3 for the policy index. That's one of the largest fiscal year returns we've seen in many, many, many years, and very good, strong relative outperformance of 160 basis points, which carried over to the 2 and 3 year number and brought the 5 year number on a relative basis back to policy after it had trailed during the financial crisis of 2007-2008 in particular. Again, Delaware highlighted, had a good quarter, and their fiscal year was up 36.3 versus 35.0 for the benchmark. And Dodge & Cox for the fiscal year up 31.1 versus 28.9. Legato did recover, as I said, in the quarter ended June 30th, which brought their fiscal year still below benchmark, 41.8, a very strong absolute return, but the Russell 2000 growth was up 43.5. And Capital Prospects had a good fiscal year number also. International managers both performed slightly above benchmark for the quarter, and for the fiscal year was above benchmark 31.5 and 31.4 respectively for LSV and Pyramus versus 30.3 for the Aquiex U.S. Index. And the fixed income managers, I think from the two that we heard today, the hiring of PIMCO was definitely a good diversifier to Dodge & Cox and a good complement to them. They do have different portfolios, you can see each had a benchmark-like returns. PIMCO right on the benchmark and Dodge & Cox slightly trailed. And for the 12 months, Dodge & Cox had strong numbers, 6.3 gross, and PIMCO 4.7. And then the real estate manager, Invesco, had a good quarter and approached the benchmark for the fiscal year of 32.9%. We'll talk about Invesco a little later in the monthly also. On page 8, the 10-year number for the plan, 6.1 versus 5.3, a good ranking of 29th percentile of other public plans greater than 100 million in value. 80 basis points of alpha annualized over 10 years equals a lot of dollars. And then page 9 is the quarterly plan attribution, and we were right on policy. You see the value added total, the second column from the far right, 0.01. Our fund was overweight equities for most of the quarter and underweight fixed. That was corrected, thankfully, in the beginning of June. I wouldn't be sleeping here for a while. I'm not sleeping well anyway. We did move $50 million from equities to fixed income June 6th, and that obviously saved us a lot of dollars given what's happened in both markets. So that helped a bit too. Pages 10, the sectors, the yellow on the bars at the kind of middle bottom is the quarterly returns, the blue or purple are the yearly returns. What really worked for the year were energy, materials, industrials, what didn't work was financials, and what didn't work for the quarter was energy and financials. We started to see risk off. Risk off includes commodities, oil. And financials were weak because of what was happening in Europe and spilling over to the rest of the markets. That has continued in the August meltdown. Financials severely underperforming, and energy's also been hit a bit also, as oil has come down to below 80s, I believe. I'm going to skip to page 14. You see Delaware starting to outperform, and now their three-year number of 6.2 versus 5.0. We told you it's a very concentrated portfolio that has a lumpy set of returns. The lumpy's been positive recently, and that's really carried over to the longer-term numbers of 3 years. On page 15 is Dodge & Cox equity. As was said, at the end of June, their numbers started to look better on a three-year basis also, and very strong on a 10-year number. And each of these active managers is offset by a passive component in large growth and large value, which I think I like. Pages 16 and 17 are the two small cap emerging managers and managers. The top page 16 is the growth, Legato. The bottom, the value, Capital Prospects. And Legato's last two quarters have been better. July, I think, was okay. And their two-year number approaches the benchmark, but since they were higher, they are above benchmark. And Capital's had very strong returns for the fiscal year, up 330 basis points. those are the domestic equities. Mellon, the S&P 500's on page 18. You can see the two largest holding, ExxonMobil and Apple. Apple's been flip-flopping with ExxonMobil now as the top capitalized company in America. You see the dividend yield of 2 at the end of June. That's 2.25 now.
And as was said, that's higher than the 10-year at 2.10. That's one valuation factor to hang your hat that equities might be reasonable or cheap now. Let's skip to page 24 in Delaware. You can see 28 securities concentrated, return of equity 20, earnings growth at 20%, much higher than the index. Top performing name was Polycom. Remember, that was the mid-cap that we waited to put in the portfolio because it was below our threshold. The price went up, it got above our threshold, they bought it. The stock did fabulously well, and it's been sold out of the portfolio at this point. And on page 25, their quarterly attribution, stock selection, 93 bips, explains most of the value added, which is what you like to see. Let's skip the index funds and go to page 30, Dodge & Cox, a more diversified portfolio of 83 stocks. You see their earnings growth much lower than Delaware's. Top 10, Hewlett-Packard has been the one that's been troubled with last week as we went over a couple of the financials there. Although you see on page 31, their financial sector, as they stated, is well below the index at 17 versus 27 as of June 30th. And that explains 60 basis points of outperformance that underweight the largest factor of why they added value for the quarter. Page 33, Legato, an emerging manager. They had five or six underlying managers, and 477 securities gives you a diversified portfolio. You don't have the manager risk like we have in the past, which is one manager. You can see the return on equity and earnings growth characteristics there. And then on page 34, they did add 129 basis points of value added in selection from the underlying managers for a good quarter there. And then capital prospects on page 36, a similar story, diversified portfolio 355 stocks, higher earnings growth than the 2000 value, and a fairly flat quarter overall on page 37. We transition to page 39, the international equity managers, LSD and Pyramus, slightly above the benchmark for the quarter. And then for the fiscal year, they both worked well together, returning a similar amount, about 100 basis points over benchmark. LSD over 3 years has added significant value, 200 basis points over the benchmark, while Pyramus has been flat. And page 40 is LSV. The portfolio, a dividend yield of 4.3 higher than the benchmark, beta of a 0.88 and a lower price to book. Those are all value characteristics. They are a value style manager. And on page 44, Pyramus, a dividend yield lower than the benchmark, beta in line with the benchmark, and a price to book higher than the benchmark. Those are growth characteristics, and that's why we pair them the way we have. Page 48 is the two fixed income managers' performance. I won't go over that since they just presented. Page 49, you see the top right currency returns. One fallout of this whole period has been weak dollar. Curious that the euro's been very strong, given all the problems over there. The only explanation that kind of makes sense that I've heard is the euro's taking on the mantra of a German mark type of, it's taking on the strongest. And it's hard to kind of intuitively think why the euro's been so strong given all these sovereign debt problems. And the yen's also been a safe haven during this whole crisis, despite their own economic growth challenges. We've seen the yield curve of Dodge and Cox on the bottom of page 49. One thing the steep yield curve does is allows the U.S. financial institutions to borrow at a very low rate, and when they're not lending that money, they get to invest it at a higher rate, and that helps recapitalize themselves also as they earn the spread differential there. And a good part of why they're not lending is just the top demand for them also.
Page is 50. Go over the sector allocations. You see our underweight on page 50 for Dodge and Cox to Treasuries, down 19.5%, and our overweight to corporates of 20%, 17%, I'm sorry. And that's one reason why they're underperforming in this time period. The good news is they're only underperforming slightly, whereas in 2008, when spreads widened dramatically, that really hurt us. That's why I asked them that question. PIMCO on page 53 and 52. PIMCO is a nice compliment because you see the Treasury at 39.3 for our portfolio, above the benchmark rating, so that has helped us in that time period. With that, I will stop. As of June 30th, it was a very strong fiscal year on a relative and absolute basis. I guess, thankfully, a lot of this has happened after the fiscal year, the first 2 months, so we have 10 months to recover, hopefully, from it. But we do have at least good news for June 30th. I'll pause for any questions before I go to the manager review list that goes along with these quarterlies. Okay, we're going to quickly go over the manager review list, item 8B. We just take from the performance report what's been going on the last 6-12 months, and alphas for 3 and 5 years, and peer rankings for 3 and 5 years. Dodge and Cox has improved. Their 3 year now is at plus 90, and their rankings for 3 and 5 years, 60 and 69. Delaware has improved dramatically, 120 bips for 3 years, and they're ranking at 26th percentile. LSV's also been very strong and improved, 200 annualized alpha with a peer ranking of 29th and a 5 years of 0 and 40th. And Pyramus, 9 is 10 for 3, plus 30 for 5, and decent rankings. And now you see Invesco with an alpha of 50 bips for 3 years and a ranking for 14th. And Dodge & Cox Equity has good numbers all across. So our recommendation is to keep everyone in good standing. We see no reason to put anyone under review, so no action is needed based on our analysis. Okay, I'm going to transition to July, which will start to bring us more current. And July was kind of maybe a precursor to a large sell-off in August. Right here, this. I'm going to start with the page A. We saw the small cap weakness, kind of the risk off, the riskier assets performed weaker. The Russell 3 was down 2.3 for the month, small caps down 3.6. And the 3 month numbers started to creep lower also. The non US ACWI ex US performed better, down 1.3%. And then bond safety, you see the aggregate up 1.59 for the month. The one-year numbers were still strong, although starting to tail off. I think at the end of April, those numbers were above 30% for 1 year. And we've seen, you know, starting to see some weakness and dropping off some good months and adding some weaker. The 10-year Russell 3 up to 3.4%. And the ACWI ex US at 8% and the Barclays AG at 5.7%. Page 1, the market value went down to just under $1.4 billion at the end of July. You see special situations is the addition of Research Affiliates to Invesco now. And you see our targets have been modified slightly, as we took international equity down from 20 to 19 to help fund the research affiliates. And the percentage of the actuals to our targets are right in line with each other. And we see Invesco and research affiliates at 1.5% targets, each making up the 3%. Page 2, the top should be the period ending July 31st, not June 30th. And the current month at the end of July was just under $1.4 billion, as I said, and it was $14.5 million down from the prior month, and $168.5 million above. SEC lending had incrementally continued to improve a bit month to month, and the equities was the asset class that got hit the most, and fixed income went up $7 million. And pages three give the targets of each of the individual managers. Their actual percentages, everyone is right in line. And page four breaks out cash. Cash is $22 million, including the fixed income, $15 million. So cash was at low levels at the end of July. And page five, the performance for July, the first fiscal month of 2012. Dodge and Cox underperformed in July. Delaware continued their strong relative performance, actually returning the positive number for their portfolio in July and adding 1.78%. Capital Prospects added 41 basis points, while Legato was in line with their benchmark. The total domestic underperformed the Russell 3000 slightly, primarily because we're overweight small caps in our portfolio versus the Russell 3000, which is at about a 10% weight. Fixed income, we had Dodge and Cox underperform and PIMCO outperform. Combined, they were 20 basis points below benchmark, as Dodge and Cox has four-fifths of the assets there. And then international, we had LSV underperformed by 56 bips, but Pyramus outperformed by 103 bips, so combined they outperformed by 25 basis points. Invesco was down slightly, but did return a positive return. And Research Affiliates, their first month was a very poor month, down 8.74%, as their tend to be long value stocks and long a lot of financials, and that cost them down 8.73%. Overall, had a $20 million funding that had an impact of about 13 basis points on the total portfolio. So by itself, it looks bad, and it is bad, but the overall effect was pretty negligible on the total portfolio. We have an agenda item to talk about that a little more briefly coming out of the gates. Overall, the fund was down 0.78% versus down 0.69% for the policy index. The portfolio actually held up okay in July. August will be the real test with what's going on in the markets then. And then the following pages are the rolling 3 years. The trend for Dodge and Cox equity is better, quite a bit from the December 2008 lows. Pyramus on page 7 continues to flatline right at 0%. Page 8, LSV has been quite strong, coming from minus 1% August 2010 to above 2% about a year later on a rolling 3-year basis. Delaware, as I said, has been very strong recently, also coming from minus 1 in March 2011 to almost about 1.75% currently. Invesco, 3 years is about 1% below the benchmark. And Dodge and Cox, on page 11, has been quite strong. I will take questions on why. And Darnell, I'll briefly talk about what's going on in the markets this month.
You mentioned securities.
Yes.
We got into trouble because of the huge drop that occurred before. Do we expect the same thing
tomorrow? That'll be my project this month.
Good.
That's a good question. Okay, August. As of the close of Friday, and that's before the market was up slightly yesterday and up about 3 to 4% today, the Russell 2000 was down 13.8% as of the close of Friday. So it's down just below 10% probably, including the 2 days this week. Small cap Russell 2000 was down 18% as of Friday, the riskier assets haven't hit harder. And again, the small caps are up stronger today. We have 62% of our portfolio in equities. Part of that's non-U.S. I don't have the non-U.S. figures, but they're similar. 60 times 10% down, that's 6% down. And our bonds at 40% have added 2 on the ag. So we're down probably about 5.25% index basis month to date, kind of give you a ballpark. And we talked about a lot of the factors causing that. The two primary are the global growth and the European sovereign debt crisis. The U.S. growth, many have already stated that we are in a recession. You can argue whether minus 0.5% growth or plus 0.5, there's not much difference, but it's pretty slow growth. And I think we would agree with Wendell that the markets have probably on the equity side priced in at least a minor recession at this point. Chinese growth is always something to look at, whether they have a soft landing or a hard landing. Right now it looks like a soft landing. Inflation, global inflation, mainly outside the U.S. and Europe, in the emerging markets, have doubled from 2 to 4%. We probably think that's topped out with the slowdown in growth and oil and other commodities starting to come down. Fed funds rate, as we said, policies leaving rates at zero to the middle of 2013. U.S. dollar weakness flows. When QE2 ended in June, we kind of warned that, you know, the liquidity going into riskier assets was over, and we watched what would happen, and it hasn't been pretty. Politics, we talked about European politics, central banks, they're kind of dysfunctional now, unfortunately. And then on the U.S., we've seen what happened with the debt ceiling and the actions there. And I think the sum has led to confusion by market participants, by corporations, and a lack of buyers, and a lot of people being frightened. On the corporate side, if you know the short-term rates are going to be held at zero until 2013, and you have all this uncertainty going on in Washington, you have no real reason to hire people or expand, or you want to get clarity before you do that, or spend money on cap spending. So that's something to watch. And, I think the one bright spot is that equities are, on a valuation basis, putting all these macroeconomic events aside, have come down to cheap levels. You get large quality, good companies selling at 10 times their earnings. That's a good thing. The big question, will those earnings continue, as was stated? We kind of all said, and voices were heard around this table, that this credit crisis is going to take it's not going to be over in 2 years. It's going to take a while, and we're starting to see that come to fruition, unfortunately. Ugly market, but stocks are getting attractive. On a dividend yield basis, new buyback announcements, had 126 authorizations in August, the largest on record. So that's kind of, an update through August, and, main things the markets are focusing on.
If market is hard economics, psychology, whatever it is, the way I understand what you're saying is it's the political problems, both in the United States and Europe, especially, that is causing a lot of uncertainty. In your comment that the Federal Reserve pinning it specifically for a period of time seems unusual and almost seems to say, I'm out of this politics. It's past the election time, etc. It seems we're driving a lot on political right now, both up and down, and I guess both directions. Which means you've got a potential going either direction, but based on fear versus optimism.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, if you put all this aside and just look at companies and what they're earning and what they're valued, it looks pretty attractive. But when you factor in these macroeconomic events, that shade points off the price-to-earnings ratio, because of all this political uncertainty, as you said.
And then what I get confused about is if Dodge and Fox can cite, say, Coca-Cola as a good alternative, but not one you want to buy, it kind of makes you wonder what's going on.
Well, they're finding other good options. They probably should have used an example.
That's
of a case
I mean.
They should have bought.
I would have expected a different
right.
example.
Like, we recently bought stock XYZ.
Right.
Because the dividend yield is higher than the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
It's selling at 10 times earning. It's raising instead of a company they haven't bought.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of companies like that out there now. Whether Microsoft or Johnson & Johnson. I mean, these are companies that floated long-term bonds at a lower rate than what their dividend is going.
So they're saying fundamentally the stocks and the companies are in good shape.
Right. But
politically and psychologically, it may not be a good time.
Well, and the worry is that if we are in a recession and it lasts longer than the market's currently priced, that's when you might see revenue start to go down and, it really affect these companies. But I think a lot of the uncertainty is political in nature today. I mean, there are steps that can be taken in Europe that would give signals to the market by floating euro bonds, by Germany having to take on, the additional job of, financing a lot of these other companies at their own expense.
Then the question is, do we want to be ready to move if things happen? If the issue of euro bond for the euro, collapses, do we act?
That's too hard of a game.
I think
the market generally often prices in before you can move. Like, if we knew 2 months ago, we would go 100% cash, right?
Correct.
Go back 2 months ago, 100% cash.
Yeah.
Okay. The last piece is, before we get to research affiliates, is the top 10 holdings. We'll start with the S&P 500 index. This is item 8D. And as of July, these prices were taken August 15th. So this was before the ugly week we had last week. And you can see the S&P, the top names, perform on a relative basis quite well, including Apple, IBM, J&J, Procter & Gamble, AT&T, and Coca-Cola. That's a lot of large cap quality, as we talked about the last few months, starting to outperform. Page two is the BlackRock Russell 1000 Growth Index. Again, we see Apple, IBM, Coke, Philip Morris, PepsiCo, large quality names outperforming at the top cap weighted area. Page three, active manager Delaware Large Cap. Also owns Apple as the largest position. Visa, MasterCard, all outperforming significantly. Looks like on the basis of their top 10 on a relative basis, they were having another good month in August. Although things change quickly in the markets these days. Page four, BlackRock, the large cap value index manager. You see top two names performing well. Financials, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo on a relative basis down. Financials have been quite weak throughout this whole period. And yes, a lot of these banks look particularly attractive on a valuation basis, but some of these banks may not make it through this whole thing either, despite the minority. We'll have to see, especially in Europe. Page 6, good evening, God. Remember last month, all 10 positions were down on a relative basis? This month, all 10 are up on a relative basis. Hope that holds. That's a very strong performance from August 5th to August 15th. Cap prospects. Small cap value has been the weakest sector during this recent decline. It's been hit hard. The top two names were down, including Gulfport Energy, although three of their positions, 6, 7, 8, and 10, were up significantly, so kind of balances out. LSV, the value manager, page 8, has had a challenging month. Looking at financials there from Europe, Allianz is the one position on the fourth, although they're not the one of the names that I've read that potentially are in trouble. But they've had a number of names down for the month. A lot of European energy companies on that list, including Repsol, Eni. Page 9, Pyramus, more winners than losers. This is as of August 15th, and a lot has changed since then. We've definitely seen a broad decline. Whenever we have a strong update like today, we haven't had follow-throughs the following day. 100-point swings in 5-10 minutes. Fortunately, we're a pension fund with a long-term investment horizon, and there's no kidding, this doesn't help. It does hurt us, but we have to have that perspective and, look at our asset allocation and rebalance like we did out of fixed equities. That will be a time when we will rebalance out of, rebalance out of equities to fix, thankfully, and there will be a time probably soon where we might rebalance out of fixed into equities. But not much. We have a verbal update on research affiliates next. We have a piece from, I think there was a one-pager from research affiliates included. And as of August 18th, they were down 5% in the month of August versus down 11.6 for the S&P. A long short should not be going down as much as they are. The only good news is that as they provided in past periods with large drawdowns, they've always had large gains since then. And I guess from our funding source, their performance, although weak, is not much weaker than what the funding source of the two international equity managers were, but they are ready to stand by if we want to call them and have them comment on their performance since we gave them the $20 million on July 1st. If not, we can move on to the agenda. Continue to stand by our recommendation, and we recognize this is not the best way to start. It's probably close to the worst way, but we do have confidence that they will dig out of this and get back to that $20 million level and then above.
I was earlier in another meeting, I was sharing with them that today I was listening to Bloomberg, and they had a speaker on talking about long short fund is underperforming the market for the next few years, or been so bad at least. Can you tell me what you think about that?
I disagree.
Why?
Well, one, you don't know what the market's going to do. If it's a huge, if they mean the market's going to rally very strongly, then they would underperform that. But in a more normal market environment, which is something I haven't seen in a number of years, I mean, this they should. Their job is to perform is to return 8% a year, 8 to 10% a year. That's what, in all market environments. And as long as they do that, I don't care if they underperform the broad market. So
well, they were actually saying 5.97% when they
paid the. Right. Well, research affiliates, I would expect 8 to 10%. And a lot of people, frankly, would be happy to get 6% return.
That's true.
It doesn't help us because it's under our return assumption, but. I don't think it's, frankly, I think it's not entirely proper to compare them against a secure long equity market. It's more an absolute return, and whether you get 6% or 8 or 10, the reason why we invested was to diversify our equity risk down and to get a, you know, the goal was to get a return of 8% net. Whether every equity long short combined outperforms the market or not, I couldn't even make a...
But you feel very comfortable that you're still going to be 8% net on this investment?
Yes, that was, yes. I did, despite the poor performance at the onset.
I think one of the issues with this particular strategy is they invest in under that they go long and undervalued sitting on long financials.
Right. And we saw how they performed in the when the market turned, it was very strong. The should be outperforming a severe downside based on the short report card actually offsetting some of that. That's the one area of concern.
Are they eliminating most of the systemic risk, market risk, when they're able?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They.
Okay.
They've done that, but they do have a. Well, they have it on a style basis. I mean, they're. And they haven't on. They are neutral. Their longs and shorts are neutral, but their longs are very different than their shorts.
So this strategy, then, the return is mostly going to come from selection, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Well, their theory is the short overvalued.
Right. Keep the beta
under a longer period of time, that should work. But in this kind of market, you know, it's questionable.
So when they have a bad return like this, do they stick with the basic long position? Okay,
yes,
so this is a long-term strategy.
Yes,
then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They just rebalance it periodically.
Got it. Do they ever get to a point where they say, maybe we shouldn't be long this? No.
No, they when they say they're uncomfortable like they are now, they personally buy more, I think.
Oh, darn. Right. Persevere.
Right.
Take one.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay, item 9. Notice of a public retirement seminar. Packet there, that first. The Internal Governance Committee, Maria's not here. Does anybody have any reports? Who's on that committee? We'll just skip it till next time.
I have a question.
On the minutes from last month's meeting, say you want to report when people go to meetings. I mean, on paper, you go to meetings. You want that verbally or you want it writing?
We've had it both ways. Usually our attorneys will write it and the members just verbally do it.
I didn't hear an answer.
Normally, it's been done both ways.
Usually if one person goes, you can just maybe verbally, and it's a two-hour one that you're going to, verbally do it, unless you feel or other people want you to write it. You need to hear it from your fellow board members.
Well, it might be interesting since the only speaker is the principal speaker here.
Right. And the reason why this is on the agenda is because there were some board members that expressed interest in attending it. So Maria had it put on the agenda. Even though she's not here. Yes. The travel costs and attendance. So Ron, his motion.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Thank you.
How many people are interested in
this? Let's see here. Michael O'Neill, I think, wanted to go. Yeah. And I'm not sure. I think,
We've got time to decide on that.
Yes. It's October 13th. At the CalPERS Auditorium, although it's being put on by the Public Retirement Journal. It's not being put on by CalPERS.
You know, I looked at the speakers and the topics, and it's classic Tom Branagh.
Okay. Okay, motion has been made and seconded. We approve this item. All of those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion is carried.
So anyone else who's interested, let me know by email.
Okay, do we have a closed session? Thank you, Ben. Okay, members forum. The only thing I have is Tom, we planned on doing a press release for the future event.
Press release?
Mm-hmm. But I think it'd probably be in order.
Sure.
We weren't sure you were going to pass the background test. Since you've sailed through that pretty well, or at least you didn't find anything, I think it's probably best to just announce that to the public for what it's worth, so everybody knows. Is that all I have? Okay, we'll go around the table. Joan? Joan, do you have anything?
No.
Karen?
Just one thing for the, probably come back to Maria for the Internal Governance Committee for next month's meeting. The email that went out, I think for just a point of clarification and for clarifying the record, since it had previously been authorized for attendance in San Francisco, I think it should come back to the board on that one event. Since the venue has changed, it should come back to the board for approval again.
What Darren's?
The IIR. Yeah.
Public Fund Boards Forum that for 19 years was in San Francisco, and you guys approved it in January for San Francisco, but then mid-year they've moved it to New Orleans, so might want to revisit that.
Yes.
So it'll be on the next agenda.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Hey, Gordon.
No. Hey, Donna. Just a reminder, Sackers is around the corner. And it's November 15th through the 18th. Hotel reservations need to be made by September 15th, so those who are interested.
And that was for what?
Sackers. Yes. Please let me know. It's in Costa Mesa, California. Mm-hmm. And that's all I have.
I don't have anything else.
You have anything, here's your chance. I'll try and keep it under 30 minutes.
You'll probably hear as we go on.
Okay, that's it. Yep. This meeting stands adjourned. Yeah.
That is November 15th through the 18th. Yes. Right. Thank you. What other one? Oh, thanks. Okay. What other one? Oh, okay. The Public Retirement Journal.
Huh?
The Public Retirement Journal you don't want. Okay.
I have a board meeting on
Monday. Yeah, you've done that before.
Thanks for the
sure.
You're welcome. It's an evening meeting I have. I can go if it's was it Wednesday, Thursday, Friday?
Oh, yeah.
If you go up that night, it starts Wednesday morning, like 8:30, 9.
My board meeting starts at 6:30.
No, on Wednesday.
But it's Tuesday meeting.
So you wouldn't be able to go afterwards? Get a light flight or anything?
Okay. So I could meet Wednesday.
Okay, well,
I don't know if that would be worth it or not.
Well, once we get the agenda, I'll email it to you and you can look at it and decide.
Okay, because I'd have to leave Wednesday morning and probably have to go out. I just don't want to miss the board meeting. If
you're prepared,
we can do something.
Sure. Okay.
I'll just leave it up to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Darren, are you thinking about going to Sackers? You want to think about it tonight?
I'll think about it. Just get that old bell in my contact at 3:00.
All those hats?
Yeah, that would be
good. Okay. I'll set up the times.
Okay.
Yes, we are.
They tell me and get our questionnaire.
I'll still be able to do the morning.
Okay, good. Very cool.
Okay, good to see you again. Karen, I got two meetings more tonight.
I'm not your
stuff.
Whenever I see a sign saying,
yeah.
No, they decided that I don't have to make one name. What did it come to visit? We made this comment
last
week. Investment.
That's right. We like these men.
Challenge yourself.
Right. Personal obligation.